All righty. Sorry about the delay there. Running a little behind this morning. All right. So we've been working through, obviously, Paul's life and some of the things that he had encountered in his missionary journeys. And now we are working on a different section where Paul is now taking a voyage from Jerusalem into the city of Rome, ultimately. We've talked quite a bit about some of the other challenges that Paul had faced along the way. And eventually that'll connect. About some of the challenges that Paul had faced along the way. And we have left off with Paul on a certain island. Anybody remember what island we left off at? Matthew, you better know. Oh, Malta? Yep. So we are left off here in the city of Malta. Let me go back and get my project open here. Technology, it's a wonderful thing. That was funny. Oh, it's all right. So we started off back in the city of Jerusalem. We kind of followed along the course, along the shore. We're going to pick it up here, go back to Myra, which was the end of the first leg of his journey, where they spent some time. Then, of course, they did some sailing, ended up in the middle of the Adriatic, which, of course, is on the other sea that's mentioned there, and although not mentioned by name, one of the two seas where they came together. And they ended up... At least you're good comic relief. Anyway, they landed in Fair Havens with the idea of trying to get over to Phoenix, but winds wouldn't allow them. So they ended up sailing around Clauda, and then they ended up over, kind of drifting around there as I have my little scattered line, and they ended up in or on the island of Malta. So when they got to Malta, Paul, of course, was bitten by a viper or a snake, and he didn't immediately die. So we talked a little bit about how the pagan aspect to that was. They at first thought he was a murderer and then figured out, oh, wait a minute, he didn't die, puff up and, you know, or puff up, die and yick. So then they figured out, oh, well, he must be a god. So it was an interesting kind of switch from what we had seen with some of Paul's other adventures. Over here in, let's go back over to Acts chapter 28, read just a couple of verses here concerning when Paul is actually on the island and some of the things that he's able to do and some of the people that he's able to minister to. So chapter 28, sorry, not chapter, yeah. Wow, my brain is not engaged yet. All right. We want to start in verse 7, Acts chapter 28, verse 7. So it says, now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the leading man of the island named Publius, who welcomed us and entertained us courteously 3 days. And it happened that the father of Publius was lying in bed, afflicted with recurrent fever and dysentery. And Paul went in to see him, and after he had prayed, he laid his hands on him and healed him. After this had happened, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases were coming to him and getting cured. They also honored us with many marks of respect, and when we were setting sail, they supplied us with all we needed. So we also talked about this a little bit last week, but Paul wasn't afraid to get into the work. There are a lot of things to do once they landed. All the sailors and all the people on the ship, they had been sailing for quite a while. They were probably all very tired and exhausted and malnourished, thirsty, cold, wet, etc., etc. So when they get on land, Paul gets involved in the work, and that's when he gets bitten by the snake. Well, then we see this happening here as well. With Publius, who was the kind of the master of the island, or at least of that particular area, well, his father, he wasn't doing well. Most likely, that was going to kill him. Fever and dysentery, especially in that particular time, without treatment, it's not a good way to go. Okay? So here's the interesting thing about this. Paul goes and he heals this guy, right? And then as a result, other people start coming to him to get healed. Why? Why did Paul do that? Super Dave?
That's one thing you're going to find throughout the whole book of Acts is Paul never missed an opportunity to do God's work. He took every chance he could. He would heal the people, talk to them about God and about salvation. He was dedicated.
Yeah. And, you know, and it might seem like an obvious thing, but I find it interesting that Paul actually spent the time to do this and to heal this guy and then to take all these other folks and to heal them. And none of these verses record anything about Paul actually being able to speak to an assembly of people. It's not like he was given the opportunity to speak at the temple and maybe debate with their pagan priests. It's not like there's a recording of a long message that he was able to give them. And I would say that a good portion of that was partially because of due to the fact that he was still a Roman prisoner, that he didn't really have the opportunity to speak as freely as he would have normally. You know, how does this apply to us today? Well, Paul's example is that your actions will often speak louder than your words, especially when you don't necessarily have free rein to say anything you want. I mean, I've mentioned this many times. I work for a very large company. They're not real big on preaching the gospel, as long as unless it's the gospel of, say, you know, homosexuality or whatever else, other than Christianity. So I have to be careful, and I'm sure most of you do as well that are in the workforce, have to be careful about what you say and how you say it. So it's not like you can show up every Monday morning and then repeat all the things that Mr. Toole mentions in his message and re-preach the gospel of salvation, you know. I'm pretty sure that your employers wouldn't necessarily approve of that. However, your actions will speak quite loudly. And this is a great example of this, because from historically speaking, we know that later on there was actually a Christian church that had developed on the island of Malta. And to my knowledge, and from knowledge from others, of course, that have done a whole lot more research on it, there's never really been an indication that any of the other apostles had ever really spent any time there. So Paul's actions certainly had some impact on Malta. And I just wanted to remind us that it's important to know that sometimes we can't always speak as freely as we'd like, but our actions will certainly speak in respect to Christ, just like what Super Dave was saying. So they get ready to leave the island of Malta. And as they're leaving, they were honored in many ways, and they were provided with whatever was necessary when they departed. Now, let's go back to this for just a second. Anybody remember how many people were on the ship? You're close. What was that, Mikkel? 276. Very close. There were 276 people on that boat. How many of them made it to land? All of them. So there's 276 people that have been cared for by the Phoenicians, or excuse me, by those in Malta, by the barbarians in Malta, right? And when they were leaving, they were honored with many marks of respect, verse 10, and when we were setting sail, they supplied us with all that we needed. That's pretty impressive. 276 people getting ready to board a ship and set sail. What was the Maltese? What was their obligation to these people? It certainly wasn't to make sure that they had everything they needed. But again, because of Paul's behavior, and I'm sure a lot of the other folks that were there on the ship that started to recognize the authority under which Paul was acting, which of course was the authority of God, I'm sure a lot of people were like, "Yeah, we're with this guy." So, again, actions really do speak quite loudly. The islanders were grateful for the miracles that were performed among them, and they showed this by providing gifts to Paul. And of course, you have to consider this for just a second. Paul, again, is still a prisoner of Rome. So it's not like they loaded him up with, you know, bags of gold and, you know, maybe a nice rack of lamb or, you know, I don't know. They certainly didn't give him anything that was too materially valuable. But you ever been in one of those situations? The example that comes to my mind is when a kid gives you something that they may have worked on. Maybe they made you a macaroni necklace, or maybe they made you an ornament for Christmas that's made out of pipe cleaners and those little beads. How much is that worth? I mean, materially, like 50 cents. But isn't it worth a whole lot more when it's given in that particular manner? So whatever the gifts were that were given to Paul, they weren't recorded, but they were important and probably valued by not only the islanders, but Paul, I'm sure, appreciated them as well. One of the important things to remember out of this is that even though Paul was given gifts, he wasn't performing the miracles for the purpose of trying to get paid for them. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 10, just to give you the definite example on this. Jesus, when he sent out the 12 disciples, had given them some pretty specific instruction. We'll just read verse 8. He says, "Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. Freely you received, freely give. Do not acquire gold or silver or copper for your money belts." And then he goes on. See, the point is that Paul wasn't doing this to try to make some money. He was doing it, as Super David mentioned, to glorify God. I'll be with you in just a sec. So you think through this, Luke's omission of any recording of Paul openly preaching the gospel in Malta, it serves as an important reminder for us that we are to be Christ to the world around us, no matter the situation, no matter the environment.
Keeping in mind, Paul didn't do this for the money or for the gifts, but to refuse such gifts would be an insult to the islanders. Yeah. You know, so yeah, he accepted the gifts for what they were.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember. I think it was. I can't remember his name. I can see his face. It was one of the preachers. He was talking at, I think it was family camp, about he had been at a family's house. And he was doing a Bible study with them, and they were not well-off people. We are amongst the poor of the land, if you will. They were not wealthy people by any means, and they made a dinner for him, and there was a nice long hair in his food. And instead of making a big deal out of it and going, and throwing it on the floor or whatever, he just ate it. Tough one for me, but how much more effective would he have been, or much less effective would he have been, if he had made a big deal out of it? So I realize that the analogy isn't exactly one-to-one, but the reality is that when people give you something, especially to show their kindness, there's nothing wrong in accepting it. Just put it that way. All right. So up to this point, anybody know how many shipwrecks Paul had been, were recorded that Paul was in by this time? Peach has got it. Four. So by this was his fourth recorded shipwreck. Because remember, the other three had been recorded in Corinthians. He had written about them to the Corinthians. Those, of course, had been written before this event. So this is now the fourth time that we see Paul experiencing shipwreck. And God was with him through all of it and would be with him as he and his traveling companions continue their journey. So this next leg of their journey is ultimately to get them to Rome. So we're here on the island of Malta, and they spend approximately 3 months there. Acts chapter 28, verse 11 there, if you see the time frame that's referenced. Let's see if I can put that there. Awesome. All right. So back to Acts chapter 28. Let's go ahead here, and we'll read a few verses. 11. We'll start here in verse 11, and we'll stop down at verse 15. "At the end of 3 months, we set sail on an Alexandrian ship, which had wintered at the island, and which had the twin brothers for its figurehead. After we put in at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days. From there we sailed around and arrived at Regium, and a day later a south wind sprang up, and on the second day we came up to Puteoli. There we found some brethren, and were invited to stay with them for 7 days, and thus we came to Rome. And the brethren, when they heard about us, came from there as far as the market of Appius and three inns to meet us. And when Paul saw them, he thanked God and took courage. So this next leg of the journey, there's not all that much that happens. You know, they had certainly had their share of adventures on the way there. They spend 3 months on the island, waiting basically for the right time to sail. This probably, when they leave Malta, it's probably somewhere around February or March, to, of course, head off to Rome. And they leave on an Alexandrian ship with the figurehead of the twin brothers. Anybody know who the twin brothers are? They're the twin brothers or the twin sons. Oh, Mr. Tool, you know?
Of Zeus.
Of Zeus. Their names are Castor and Pollux, which, by the way, there are still some celestial items named after them. We'll not go into that. But Castor and Pollux were the two that were the twin brothers here. I just find this interesting. As they leave St. Thomas Bay, which is, archaeologically speaking, probably the most likely area where Paul had landed, we see them leaving from Malta to Syracuse. See if I can grab this picture. So this is an example of what that figurehead on the front of the ship would have looked like. Okay? Just found it interesting. It kind of gives you a visual there. So Castor and Pollux were the two that were on that on the head of the ship. They sail to Syracuse, which is, of course, the capital of Sicily. And for all you geography nuts, it's the ball that Italy's kicking. So there's Italy. There's the boot. There's the ball. So anyway, they arrive there in Syracuse, make a short stop, and then they sail up to Regium. So Syracuse, up to Regium. And then from Regium, they get a south wind and they sail on to an area called Puteoli. So Puteoli is a bit further north. It's a little bit closer to Rome. Obviously, it was a major seaport at the time, and would have been a place where, well, I'll get to that in just a second. Mike.
So the ship, did they just go to the rental agency and get that, or what?
The ship had rent a boat. No, it's the ship would. Yeah, Avis rent a ship. It was probably one of the Roman vessels, and it had wintered on the island. So most likely, one of the things that, from an archaeological perspective, they may have traveled north, or Publius may have had some contacts to notify the ship that had probably been up north in what is today called St. Paul's Bay. It's a little difficult to decide whether they left from there or if they left from St. Thomas. I would imagine they probably left from where they were with 276 people, especially Roman prisoners, probably didn't want to make the overland trek from one end of the island to the other. So they probably hired it down from the north.
So that's amazing, too, just that they were able to coordinate that from afar.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like they had email or phone.
Right. And remember, they spent 3 months on the island, so that was probably one of the first things that the Roman centurion Julius had put in place to try to get that done. So, good question. Okay, so they land in Puteoli, and this is an interesting area, this Puteoli. I'm not going to get too much into it, other than just to point out where it's at, and this yellow line here that you see on the line, we'll cover this here in just a second. Anybody have any idea what that is? If I pull out just a little bit here. What's it look like? Four-letter word starts with an O, ends with a D, has an OA in it. Road. It's a road. It's actually, in Italy, it's called SS, I think it's SS7. this actually follows the path of the original Roman road. So you do a little digging. It's actually kind of interesting because if you follow along that that road, obviously what we see now is considerably different than it was a couple thousand years ago. But as you follow along, there's all these little monuments to the Roman cities and some patches where you can actually see stretches of the Roman road that are still in existence. They're not being used. They're being preserved for archaeological and historical reasons. But this gives you a really good idea of the route that they would have taken to get to Rome. There's a couple places that I mentioned, or that the scriptures mention, that these folks from Rome had come down to visit Paul. And guess what? They're on the Roman road. So I just find it amazing that the Roman roads, if you were to take a map of the old Roman roads, and then you were to overlay them with a map of, say, modern transportation lines, they follow the Roman road system. It was that well built. So anyway, find it interesting. So from Puteoli, they begin the road to Rome. Paul, Luke, Aristarchus, and presumably Julius, the centurion, stay in Puteoli for 7 days, which could have been 1 or 2 Sundays. 7 days. I think maybe Paul had the opportunity to break bread. Maybe made sure and find that opportunity to break bread. Maybe once or twice. Probably took the opportunity to teach a little bit and to kind of update him on what's been going on. Maybe even tell him a little bit about the journey that he'd been on. He had stopped. This is not unusual for Paul. There are two other places where we have talked about where Paul had stopped previously for at least 7 days. One of them is really obvious. It's the one that we always talk about, Troas from Acts chapter 20. And the other one was Tyre. So I think it's interesting that, again, Luke records they stayed for 7 days. I would think that, I know that Paul would have made the point to break bread with the brethren. And given Julius's recognition of who Paul actually was, one of the things that you'll see as Paul later on in his life, and we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail, but he actually writes about how he began to have some success amongst those of the Praetorian Guard. Those were the ones in Caesar's household. So it's not unlikely to consider that Julius would have given him a little bit more leeway after he had dumped all of his prisoners. And probably most of his regiment. The only people that we have recorded here, and the assumption that we can make, is that it was Julius, Luke, Aristarchus, and Paul. So I would tend to believe that after all the things that Julius had seen with Paul, he was probably giving him a little bit more respect and a little bit more freedom than he would have gotten otherwise. So they meet the brethren. They spend 7 days there. And while they're in Puteoli, brethren from the city of Rome hear of their coming, and they come down to meet Paul and some of his companions on the road. So you look here. There's that Roman road that I talked about. There's the three inns and the Market of Appius. So not much left of these places, the Market of Appius especially. But they had come down from Rome, so Rome's up further north, had come down to this three inns. Sorry, I had it backwards. Three inns there's not much left of. That's it. Not much left of that archaeological site. There's a little bit of a building here, and they have some of the old ruins here, but there's not a lot left of it otherwise. But all three inns really means is just three shops. So we tend to think of an inn like a place to stay, or some translations will say taverns. It was just a shop. It was just a place where, you know, think of it like a gas station cafe. Okay? And then if we go down here, down a little bit further, we'll get down to the Market of Appius, which there's still a little bit more detail that you can see in this particular area. Again, not all that much. It's essentially a field with a few archaeological markers and some research that's going on there, but not a lot otherwise. But I bring these out because, again, you can see that this is on the Roman road, and as you follow that Roman road, it goes all the way into the heart of Rome. Okay? So, Paul, of course, back to Acts chapter 28, verse 16, verse 15, we'll start there. And the brethren, when they heard about us, came from there as far as the market of Appius and Thriens to meet us, and when Paul saw them, he thanked God and took courage. When we entered Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with a soldier who was guarding him. So they finally make it into Rome itself. So we'll wrap up the notes, and then I'll show you a couple of things on the map here that are, I think, again, interesting and help to solidify. They arrive in Rome. Julius the centurion, who again was put in charge of Paul and his care and getting him specifically to Rome, delivers him as a prisoner to the captain of the guard, and then Paul was permitted to dwell by himself with a soldier who guarded him. So we've talked a little bit about this before. In previous examples where Paul had been with a soldier, in most cases when he was appearing in, say, Caesarea, good example, he probably would have been chained to a soldier. In this case, it's a little debated or whether or not he was chained to this soldier full time. But what we do know is that he was able to talk and to have visitors and to write and to be able to preach and teach and partake in the Lord's Supper and things like that. I don't think that the soldier would have been shackled to him the whole time for that. I think it would have been more like a resident security guard, if you will. Will.
I'd assume this would be considered abnormal because of inherent prisoner. How much of this is because Paul being a Roman citizen, not really showing any hostility or reason to be overly guarded? How much of this freedom is granted because of that versus, say, a normal prisoner who just wasn't a Roman citizen?
That's a good question. I don't know a lot of what the normal approach would have been, but with Paul, remember the letter that had been sent with Julius and others about Paul's particular situation? I think that would have had a lot to do with it.
The only reason Paul's on the trip anyway is because he's Roman, because he appealed to Caesar. Yep. If you're not a Roman citizen, you don't have that right to appeal. Right. So that would be a drastic difference.
Yep, absolutely. So, yeah, Paul's citizenship certainly had a lot to do with it. But, yeah, good question. Okay. So, Paul being permitted to dwell by himself, it gives him the opportunity to continue to write, and that's really the next few sections that we'll cover in the life of Paul. There's not a lot left of the book of Acts, but there's a whole lot of things that happen between now and really the end of Paul's life, and we're going to cover quite a bit of that. So, let's go back to Romans chapter 1, and I say back because he had written it previously. Romans chapter 1, this was several years before a lot of these events had occurred. Several years before he had gotten to Jerusalem, and all the things that had occurred in this 2 years spending as a prisoner in Caesarea, and, you know, backing that up to Jerusalem, and almost being killed by the mob, and then all this journey and the shipwrecks and so on and so forth. Paul had written well ahead of time in Romans chapter 1, verses 8 through 10. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, because your faith is being proclaimed throughout the whole world. For God, whom I serve in my spirit in the preaching of the gospel of his Son, is my witness as to how unceasingly I make mention of you. Always in my prayers and making request, if perhaps now at last by the will of God, I may succeed in coming to you. And the Lord carried it out. I mean, the Lord got him to Rome safely through much tribulation and did it again on Rome's dime. The church didn't have to foot the bill, if you will, to get him there. Paul, of course, has his desire granted to go. And then for 2 years, he'll spend some time in Rome. Yeah, he was a prisoner, and he was awaiting his appeal before Caesar. But as we'll see in the next study, it was definitely a fruitful time for Paul. In other words, he didn't just sit around. I mean, there's a significant number of letters that are written by Paul while he's in prison. He preached a lot, wrote a lot, talked to a lot of people, I'm sure, had regular visitors, and we'll cover some of that as we get into the next section. What helped Paul through his voyage and really the last few years of his life was the God to whom I belong and to whom I serve. So Paul writes about him in Acts chapter 27, and we'll get there a little bit later. But later, 2 Timothy chapter 4, let's go over there. This, of course, is much later in Paul's life, the last recorded letter we have from him. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Let's start in verse 16. Verse 18 is the one I want to focus on, but we'll start in verse 16 for context. He says, "At my first offense, no one supported me, but all deserted me. May it not be counted against them. But the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, so that through me the proclamation might be fully accomplished, and that all Gentiles might hear. And I was rescued out of the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil deed and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen." It's pretty remarkable that Paul has that mindset. You know, that's ultimately a mindset that we each need to have, that our eventual home is heaven. That's our goal. And no matter what happens here, the Lord's going to direct us and he's going to keep us safe as long as we need to be kept safe so that we can accomplish what we need to accomplish. I hope that Paul's example of faith and his example of his life and the deeds that he had accomplished and the things that he's taught to this point encourages us all to serve the same God with the same faith that he did and that he died with. All right, Mike.
It's encouraging Paul's display of tremendous faith in verse 16. You know, and his first defense, no one supported me.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he continued, obviously he continued on. Mm-hmm. And he persevered. And I just wanted to point out that that would not have happened if he didn't have tremendous faith. Yeah. When those things happen to us, we tend to go to our default settings, if you will. And unless we have tremendous faith and a tremendous perspective of a spiritual perspective, we're not going to succeed in the fashion that we are meant to.
Right.
And so in the times that we're in today, that we find ourselves in today, it's vital that we continue in the green tree, in the brown tree, whichever the case is, to drive our taproot of faith deep, because we can all stand by and say, well, if something like that happened to me, I would stand. I know that I would. Well, take heed, because when those things happen, we don't know for sure. All we know is you better drive that faith deep.
And that's, what is it that you always say? Where are you living? Where's your mind dwelling? Super Dave.
Also, if you remember back at the beginning of Acts, Paul was zealous for God even before he became a Christian. Mm-hmm. He was just going about it the wrong way.
Yeah.
Then when he had the vision and the revelation, the 3 years' worth of revelation, he saw how Jesus suffered and was true to God. Mm-hmm. And he was put in that position, and he was shown how much he would suffer. You know, so he knew what was coming before he ever started this. And he had enough faith, like Mike said, you know, to continue to move forward and to hold fast.
Yep. You know, and that's a promise that's given to the Christian, that for all those who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. It's not that we have a persecution complex. It's just the reality of the world in which we live. And Mike's comments are spot on, because I'll never forget it, and I'm sure many of you won't, or most of you won't if you knew about it before, but one of the families in Bozeman had lost one of their children to an accident. And I remember that he got up and he preached a morning devotion, and he talked about how, and it wasn't long after either. I don't know, I think it was maybe a year, if anybody remembers, I think it was within the year. And he did a great devotion. And one of the things that he pointed out is that persecution doesn't necessarily refine your character, it reveals it. And that's exactly what Mike's getting at. The thing is that all, like I said, I'm not a big sailor. Sharks are real. I don't think that I would have liked very much being shipwrecked on an island. I didn't know at all where I was. And just as, obviously, I've never been in that situation. I've been lost in New Zealand and almost died, but that's a whole other story. And that was due to my own stupidity. But the reality is that those kinds of events in our lives, they're going to reveal where we're at. And if we continue to ask the question, where are we living? If we continue to drive that taproot of faith deeper, if we continue to focus on the things that are positive and good and participate, our faith is going to be strong enough to help us through. All right, so let's wrap up a couple of things here with the map. I was planning on getting to a review today, but we don't have enough time. So we'll go through this and then might wrap it up a little bit early. And I'm going to turn this so I can see a little better. You guys see okay? Or am I standing in your way? All right. So this is one of those things that it's somewhat frustrating to me, but it's reality. This is supposedly where Paul spent his time in Rome as a prisoner. And of course, and I can't see that, so I need to move this. One of the things that's so frustrating to me is the specifically how much, well, you'll see. I hope, if I can get my mouse to move, there it is. So, of course, you think, oh yeah, that's probably where Paul was staying. Well, no, it's actually over here. And no, it wasn't like that when he was there. every place that the saints ever were basically has turned into some sort of Catholic monument. And it's a little frustrating because, you know, there is one that we'll look at here that's pretty neat, but this is there's now a museum and a college and all kinds of stuff on the place where Paul supposedly lived for the 2 years. Historically, it seems accurate that that's where he was, not very far away from where he would have been, where the rest of the Roman, say the Colosseum. Let me slow down just a little bit here. There's your Colosseum. And then we just left where Paul was in his historical residence there. And then this is the prison that he would have been housed in. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we continue to move forward. And I don't want to get too much more into that detail, but this is where Paul probably would have spent the days leading up to his death. This is actually a pretty interesting area. A lot of this is still in ruins, and it hasn't been ruined by Catholic churches. But you can actually see quite a bit of the old architecture in here. So let me grab my little guy here. So you can see some of the Roman architecture that would have been in place in Paul's time, some of the other ruins in that area. And then I wanted to go back over here. So that's what it was. That's what it looks like today. They were doing some restoration in the other photo there. So, but you look out over here, you can see all the old Roman columns, a lot of what's left of the rest of the prison, and what would have been a palace to a certain extent, or at least a government dwelling place. Essentially, think of it like a city hall type thing, is what a lot of this other area was. Okay? So that is the prison where Paul would have spent the last, you know, the time leading up to his death. This is the area where the traditional location of Paul's... Actually, I got to go back there for just a sec. This is the traditional location of where Paul was executed. I can't pronounce the Italian, but it basically means the Abbey of the Three Fountains. Now, anybody have any idea where that name would come from? If you're not Catholic in background, you probably wouldn't. And I didn't either. I had to look it up. I'm like, why do they call it Three Fountains? Well, supposedly, and we have a pretty good understanding that Paul was beheaded. Exactly where, we don't know. Hello. But the traditional location is right here. In that courtyard area, and there are three fountains that are there. And supposedly, now this is where Catholicism aligns with paganism remarkably well. And yes, I'm picking on the Catholics, because you do any research on it and it's ridiculous. But anyway, supposedly when they cut Paul's head off, it bounced three times. And every place where it bounced, a fountain came up. Well, if you actually look into the geology and of this, those fountains were in place a long time before Paul was ever there. But yet, it fills pews when you have these remarkable events like this occurring. So, anyway, and then finally, we'll go back up here. This is the area where Paul, considered by most scholars, where Paul is buried. Interesting story there. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we get there. This is the amount of money that's spent on these places is amazing to me. And I realize that it's been long since spent, but these huge buildings and monuments to people. You ever wonder why God hid the body of Moses? So, anyway, that's what we've got for today. Probably the last of the map stuff that we'll do. Hopefully it was enlightening and helped you kind of make some connections. So, yeah. And if anybody wants it, I can send you a link to this Google Earth thing so you can spend hours looking at 3D buildings and street views and whatnot. It's a lot of fun. Anyway, so thank you for your time. And next week we'll do a review. And just so you know, I have candy. All right. Thanks.